The next case on the calendar is United States v. Hollins.
May it please the court, Barclay Johnson for Andrew Hollins. Because Mr. Hollins was serving a New York State sentence when he was transferred into federal custody, none of his time on federal pretrial detention would count toward his federal sentence, even though his earliest release date and his statutory conditional release date in New York passed while he was in federal custody awaiting sentencing. He raised this issue at his change of plea, in a motion to be returned to state court, at a hearing on that motion, in a sentencing memorandum, and at the sentencing hearing. And while the district court denied his request to be returned to New York, the court said it would be receptive to that argument at sentencing. It would listen to the arguments at sentencing and try to take the arguments into consideration. Given this, obtaining some credit for his time in federal pretrial detention was the central issue at his sentencing.
Didn't she also, though, at that hearing express some skepticism, saying, well, if it's appropriate, but she expressed some skepticism that your client would be, in fact, would have been paroled if he'd been in New York?
She did. The record, though, shows that counsel spoke with staff at the New York Parole Board and reported to the court that it was pretty likely that he'd be paroled on his conditional release date, the earliest release date having already passed. I think to that we can add that New York conditional release is a statutory type of release that is generally available to people so long as they're in state custody.
But doesn't that argument you're making now really go to whether you think the district court got it wrong and should have granted him release, should have made a different assessment of whether he would have likely been released by New York authorities, which is different, I thought, from your argument that the district court misapprehended its ability to decide whether to give him a lower sentence because of this back and forth between New York and federal custody, and that she didn't in fact make a decision. Those strike me as two different arguments. One is that she made the wrong decision, and one is that she didn't actually decide.
We're arguing both of them.
Okay.
Judge Livingston's reference to the comments were to comments the judge made at the earlier hearing. I think the very absence of those same comments as a reason for denying a request shows that she did not reach the request.
How far apart were those hearings? Could you remind me?
The first one was November 26th. The sentencing hearing was January 31st of the following year.
It's not very long time. It seems that part of your argument is suggesting to us that she must have forgotten.
I wouldn't say.
Strikes me as not very plausible.
I wouldn't say forgotten. I would say, the interaction of federal and state sentences is one of the more complicated things we deal with. And
yeah.
I think the court got it wrong, did in fact get it wrong, did in fact not rule on the request. And
okay, I'm sorry. Now I'm hearing three. I thought that there were two coming in. Judge Nardini pointed to what I think a third, and it would help me. So one is, she ignored your argument, which is what I thought you started off by saying. The second is that she didn't think she could depart from the guidelines. And then the third is she got it wrong. Are you making two of those three, one of those three, all three of those three?
We're making two arguments. One, that she did not, in fact, rule on his request.
So that's the ignored?
Yes.
Or, right, okay. And then, so you have abandoned your, she didn't think she didn't have the power?
No, I think that the
sentence. That's why she ignored it.
Yes, I think the court was focused on a different, a related issue to be sure, but a different issue, and not the issue and claim that he was raising at sentencing.
Okay, so does that mean it turns on how we read the transcript? If we read the transcript and think she didn't ignore it, and she didn't think she didn't have power, but rather she disagreed, or she, is that answer at least the procedural argument? Maybe not the substantive argument, but at least the procedural argument?
I think it could. As you look at the transcript, the ultimate ruling at Appendix 176 begins and ends with the district court saying, this is for the BOP. The judge says, with regard to the credit, that's really for the Bureau of Prisons to address, and then ends by saying, I leave that to the Bureau of Prisons. I think that suggests the court got focused on the sentence computation issue, which is related, but not the same as Mr. Holland's claim, which is it's not fair under these circumstances, and the court should adjust the sentence to take into account this time spent on pretrial release or pretrial detention. And I think you see it also, just the prior page in the appendix, 175, in the court's final discussion with Mr. Holland's counsel. Counsel first clearly says that Mr. Holland's request is that the court please consider an adjustment of the time that he's not gotten credit for. The district court then asks a question about 3585B and sentence computation, and counsel responds saying, yes, that's how 3585B works. But, quote, I'm saying that's not fair under these circumstances, and ask the court to consider, quote, a credit for some of the time that before today that the Bureau of Prisons will not give him any credit because he's been serving a New York State sentence.
Can I ask, putting the procedural issue aside, if we're limited, I think you would agree, to reviewing whether the sentence was outside the range of permissible outcomes, is that right?
It's an abuse of discretion, and the court abuses a discretion. It's a discretion if it misapprehends its authority, which we think it did, being focused on, I think, mistaking the sentence computation issue for what the sentence should be under 3553A, and then not ruling on his request for a credit. I'm not sure if that answered your question, though.
Well, it seems to me ultimately you're saying that had the credit been happened, or had the credit been given, or there was a lost opportunity to get a shorter sentence, and I'm just not sure how a few months might have taken it outside the permissible range.
Well, I think the court, this I think goes to the prejudice, and his sentence was in fact in the middle of the guideline range, and so his request was for some credit, and the court could easily have granted, had it been focused on this, some months. The conditional release date, the earliest release date, the first date he appeared in federal court. But a good bit of that could have been well within the guideline range again. And I see my time has expired.
Thank you. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning. May it please the court, Andrew Gilman on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, the defendant's below-guideline sentence of 62 months for his wire fraud, money laundering, and cocaine distribution convictions was procedurally and substantively reasonable. There are two primary points I'd like to address this morning, both calling for affirmance of the district court's sentence. First, contrary to the defendant's claim, the district court, in imposing sentence, properly considered and denied Holland's request to receive credit on his federal sentence for the time he spent in federal custody serving a separate New York State sentence for a separate New York State conviction.
On the procedural claim, the thrust is, what do we make of the district court referencing the Bureau of Prisons? We'll leave that to the Bureau of Prisons. What other parts of the transcript demonstrate that she knew she had the authority and was just declining to exercise it?
Yes, Your Honor. Looking at the record here, it's clear before sentencing and at sentencing, the district court understood this claim, considered it, and ultimately at sentencing, in the same paragraphs that my colleague is recounting in Joint Appendix 176, denied this claim. It's clear from the November 26th hearing that the district court understood its power to consider and credit the time that the defendant was in federal custody on a writ, serving a separate sentence, and left that determination for sentencing. Then at sentencing, the district court explicitly recognized Holland's claim on the record. This is Joint Appendix 172. The district court said, quote, in phrasing Holland's claim, the district court described it as, quote, I'm getting no federal credit for the time I've been here on the writ. And the government in response agreed, but replied that he's just not getting credit at the present time for the time he's spending, the time in federal custody, because he's getting credit for that time from the state. Then, right before the court went to impose sentence, the defendant raised this claim again. He said he has not gotten credit up until this time because he's still serving a New York State sentence. That's Joint Appendix 175. And the court questioned this claim, engaging with it. It said, so isn't the way it works from the Bureau of Prisons, he is getting credit, it's just for another sentence. That's Joint Appendix, same page. The defendant agreed, conceded that that's correct under 18 U.S.C. 3585, but I'm saying that's not fair. In issuing sentence, the court clearly denied this claim for past credit. It explained, quote, this is not a case in which the defendant is in our custody getting credit on no sentence. It just isn't. He's being credited in New York for his time, and the way the Bureau of Prisons looks at it is, quote, are you getting the same credit for another sentence? Because otherwise it's double counting. But I leave that to the Bureau of Prisons. That last throwaway line about the Bureau of Prisons should not take away from the court's clear denial of this past credit. And in fact, it's true under 3585 that the Bureau of Prisons is responsible for the ministerial computation of sentence. At the same time, critically, in that hearing, the district court denied the government's request for a consecutive sentence, given that the federal offenses were so separate from the New York State firearm offense. And in recognizing that balance, the court ruled, giving him future credit so that he receive, once a concurrent sentence was imposed, the defendant would receive credit on both his New York State sentence and his federal sentence. And that balancing of factors shows that the district court did what it had to do under the Supreme Court's precedence in Rita, where the court set forth that the sentencing judge need only, quote, set forth enough to satisfy the appellate court that she has considered the party's arguments and has a reasoned basis for exercising her own legal decision-making authority. Turning to the second point, Your Honors, this sentence, a below-guideline 62-month sentence for a defendant convicted of multiple federal felonies who was in the highest criminal history category, was substantively reasonable. The defendant's offenses of conviction involved a wire fraud with an intended loss of over $350,000, money laundering to conceal the proceeds of that wire fraud, which involved the use of drug-addicted individuals to help launder those proceeds, misappropriation of identities, and also involved the defendant dealing cocaine. This same defendant had an extensive criminal history. He had three prior New York State felony firearm offenses and a prior federal narcotics conviction in Vermont. This sentence is well within the range of permissible decisions and should be upheld. Thank you.
Before you sit down, can I ask you to tell me how you think we should read Los Santos?
Which, Your Honor?
Los Santos, our 2002 case. 2000. He cites it for the proposition that a missed opportunity for a concurrent sentence could serve as a basis for a downward departure.
That is correct, Your Honor, that a a sentence, I guess the proposition, I'm not sure I fully understand the court's question.
He made a big deal of the Los Santos case, and I wanted to see how you thought we should read it.
I'm not immediately familiar with that case, Your Honor, I apologize. The thrust of the focus here was really the credit claim. And here, it's clear that Mr. Hollins was getting credit for the time he was in federal custody on a writ on a totally separate New York State conviction and separate sentence. And the court did all it had to do under this court's case law in Lawrence and the Supreme Court's decision in Rita to make sure that it properly considered and ruled on the defendant's claim. If there are no further questions, I'll rest on the papers. Thank you, Your Honors.
I think Judge Nardini mentioned that it's a couple months isn't that long a time, but I think that one, it's a complicated issue, and two, this goes to the deference. And while the court typically would defer to a district court and assume it fully recognized its authority, this court has also said where there's ambiguity, where it's unclear that a district court understood an available sentencing option, we won't.
I don't think I was the one who mentioned a couple of months, but I thought when it was brought up by the court, that was in the context of whether it was a substantively unreasonable sentence, and we have to find that a sentence is shockingly high or otherwise unsupportable as a matter of law, such that it undermines the administration of justice. So I took the question about a couple months as going to the notion that when we're talking about substantive unreasonableness, we have to talk about a sentence that is shockingly high. And it does seem it would be hard to believe that a sentence that is only 2 months longer, say, than what it ought to have been would have been shockingly high. But I thought that's a different question from the question of whether a district court misapprehended its power to grant a lower sentence based on a particular right. thing. And that strikes me as a procedural unreasonableness error about the method by which the court calculated a sentence.
I think we agree, and this court has said that the deference that we would typically afford a court as to whether it fully understood the sentencing options is not appropriate where there's an ambiguity, where it's unclear from the record whether the judge correctly understood an available sentencing option. We think this is exactly that case, and this court has said where there's a substantial risk that a judge misapprehended the scope of his or her departure authority, we're more inclined to remand for clarification. We think that is exactly what the court should do here.
Your argument just runs a little bit into the, there's a reference, there may be some references where she could have been clearer, but reading the record as a whole and taking into account her statements at the in addressing the motion to return your client to state custody, it's crystal clear in November that she understood her authority, and she told you exactly what she told your client exactly what she would like to hear at sentencing if she were to exercise that authority in his favor. I'm not sure that we can disregard that in understanding and instead interpret a view of the record that would seem to say she had completely expunged her well-expressed understanding of her authority weeks earlier for a stray reference to I leave that to the Bureau of Prisons.
We're not asking you to ignore the earlier references because we agree they're very clear. And the judge, in fact, gives examples of what she would have found persuasive. But at the same time, that's completely absent at sentencing. The same page counsel points to, I really think that is, those are references to how a sentence is computed, when a sentence commences. And then in the ruling, it's not a stray reference or two. It's, with regard to the credit, that's really for the Bureau of Prisons to address. And I leave that to the Bureau of Prisons. I think at a minimum, that creates the kind of ambiguity that this court has said the better thing to do is to remand for clarification.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
And we will take the matter under advisement.